Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, it's Scary. We are so glad to be with you tonight. Another great show, another great lineup of panelists. Let's talk first of all about who all's here that is going to discuss this very, very interesting topic. First of all, from the Midlands of South Carolina, the Surgeon General of ScaryCast, the one and only Dr. Trey Donaway. Dr. Trey, how you doing tonight, buddy?
I'm doing fine tonight, John. After a rainy day and a rainy evening, happy to be here.
Well, that's great. Well, we are certainly glad to have you. And the greatest wrestler in Ravenel, South Carolina, my co-host on Pro Wrestling Interviews, and one of the most entertaining and best friends I've got, the amazing Velvet. How are you doing, Velvet, tonight?
I think my pants are on fire now. I'm good. I love you, dude. You made
it terrible. You're terrible, but that's why we like you. That's why we like you.
Oh my God.
Oh my,
I can't help myself.
West Hollywood. One, the only Devin Tate, the longest host of ScaryCast. How are you doing tonight, buddy?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here with y'all. Hello, Velvet. Hello,
yay. Hey, buddy.
Yeah, hi, everyone. Good to be here.
Well, we are glad to have you here. And we have two other co-hosts, which I'm excited about. First of all, from the land of cheese, from Wisconsin, Keith Pacetti, who he and I have all these great conversations about the paranormal and everything, and I knew he would like being on this show. So, Keith, how are you doing tonight?
I'm pretty good. Thank you, Dr. John.
We're so glad to have you. And the one and only, the professor of wrestling, is here. Steve Logan, how are you doing tonight from Richmond, Virginia?
Doing good. Just about to eat some dinner, so I'll probably listen in.
Steve-o, what's up?
Well, we're glad to have you here. And I will say that Robin will be back next week. Robin has not been feeling well, but she's getting better. I talk to her every day, and I'm thrilled that she's going to be back next week. We love her to death. She is absolutely the queen of ScaryCast and so much fun to have. So she'll be back with us next week. But we're glad to have – we've got our A-list panel here tonight and our guest. Now, let me tell you the story. This past Saturday night, we had the inaugural podcast of Lifetime Carolinas, and I had my buddy Ralph Gerrels on, and we talked about his book, Jesus, Judas, and oh my goodness, Ralph, help me out. Jesus, Judas, and Best Friends Forever. Best Friends Forever. So what I said, I called Ralph this morning and I said, would you please be on ScaryCast? Because I think everybody would be interested in what you've got to say. Our panelists, I think, are going to be very interested, and you were kind enough to join us. So first of all, Ralph, thank you very much for being with us, and how are you doing tonight?
Thank you, and I enjoy this, and it's a great opportunity. I appreciate meeting everyone, and I'm happy to be here. I'm feeling good. It's a little wet here, probably not as swampy as it is down in Ravenel and some other places in the state, but you know, a week later, and you know it'll be fine and too hot. So if it's not too hot, it's too cold or too wet. So we live in South Carolina.
Exactly.
That's exactly right. And everybody that complains about it being too hot in South Carolina will go somewhere else. We love the hot weather occasionally, and it's not bad. So anyway, Ralph, we're so glad to have you. And I was introduced to you by our mutual friend, our very good mutual friend, Uncle Doug Kelly. I call him Uncle Doug for many reasons. So, and he introduced us. We were at Dirty Don's Oyster Bar, and you were up there, and you had your book about Anne Bonny. Anne Bonny is the really the premier female pirate, I guess, of all time in the New World. But then you told me about this other book that you had, in this book about Jesus and Judas, and I said, "Oh wow, I got to get you on my show." So, and we finally did. So, why don't you tell us give us the summary of Jesus and Judas, best friends forever, and then we've got a lot to talk about. This is a huge, huge topic that is seldom really discussed among historians.
Well, thank you, and again, I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show. You mentioned Anne Bonny, and so let me talk about her just for a second. Anne Bonny was the first female pirate of note, and she lived in Charleston. She grew up in Charleston. She moved there with her father and her mother when she was 1 year old, and from that point she lived in Charleston. But she lived an unbelievable life, and I'm told the book is interesting, and, you know, it's printed and published, so at least my publisher thought it was interesting. Jesus, Judas, Best Friends Forever. The whole concept for this book and my first novel, The Ill-Gotten Gain, is questions that I had when I was a teenager and in church, and things that just needed some more information, or at least I thought so. And historic fiction, the best thing about it, which is the genre that I write in, is that there is a structure that is history, and so it's documented. But most of it, they leave great big holes. And for a creative writer, all you really have to do is go back and fill in the holes. So theoretically, it's easy, but it's not as easy as it sounds. Jesus and Judas, all we know about Jesus is we know he was born circa 1 AD. We know that as a baby, his mother and father took him to Egypt. Then we know that at age 12, he was at the synagogue in Jerusalem. And then we know that at age 30, he started his ministry. Now, you know, so what happened in all that downtime? And that's sort of the basis for this. I think it provides an answer to the chronology of Jesus and his preaching from birth to age 12 to age 30. And then I've included a chronological account of his preaching during his ministry. But, you know, you can't start doing research without surprising yourself, I think. And at least in this case, it did. Number one is when you think of the Last Supper, I'm pretty sure that Leonardo da Vinci's mosaic is what comes to mind. And based on all of the research, Leonardo didn't even come close to getting it right. First of all, he's got all of the participants sitting in chairs, and at that time they would have never sat in chairs. They ate while reclining. They would recline on their left side, and they would eat with their right hand, and that's cultural to some extent, because in that era the left hand was used for personal hygiene, and so you couldn't eat with it, and also it wouldn't be nice if you offered your left hand to shake. That would be considered an insult. But anyway, the table that Leonardo shows is a straight table with Jesus sitting in the middle. The common practice at that time for Jews and Romans was to sit at a table that looked like an open sea. And it's called a triclinium. And that there actually is one of these that is in existence. It was found during the excavation of Pompeii. And it is a table that allows for everybody to sit and see each other, which is different than what we're shown with Leonardo's paint or mosaic. We're able to document where at least four of the participants sat. Jesus, who was the host of the Last Supper, which logically enough would have been a Seder meal because all of them were practicing Jews, would have sat in the second place on the left-hand portion of the sea. And that's because that was the place that the host sat. To his right would have been John, the beloved disciple, because he was youngest and he was, again, loved by Jesus. So that was an honored place. And the next to him on his left would have been Judas. And then Peter, who is considered at least by himself, at least as the chief apostle, sat across from John on the other side, on the first seat on the right-hand side of the sea. Now, all of that's documented in the Bible, or at least it appears to be. In John 13:23, John is said to lean into Jesus' bosom to ask who shall betray him. The only way that would have been possible is if John was sitting to reclining to Jesus' right. Jesus said that he who sops with my cup, or he who I sop with, will be the one that betrays me. And I'm not sure betray is the right word, but that's a whole nother story. But Judas had to sit next to him because the only way you could eat out of the same cup is be right next to each other. Now, and that's documented in John 13:24. And finally, the question of Peter sitting across the table is documented in Luke 22:26-27. And it just simply says that Peter sat across from John. Now, there are a couple of interesting things about that. The place that Peter sat was the seat of the servant. It was the duty of the person sitting there to wash the other's feet, and he was typically the only, invited to the dinner in order to do the work of washing feet and getting people seated. I think Jesus was telling Peter and giving a visual demonstration of the whole idea of he who would be great must be a servant. So all of that, the Last Supper, which I found unbelievably interesting, because nobody believes it, or nobody now believes it. Also, the book provides a couple of other things. It provides a little bit of an explanation as to why Judas was chosen as a disciple or an apostle. He was the only non-Galilean that was a disciple. He was from Judea. And the other things are basically to combine what would have been normal life actions of that time period, their religious belief and how they accommodated it. And I also provide a list of time and space distances, because we have a tendency to I think, in our time period, think of travel in the way we travel. So making a trip to Charleston from Columbia is a simple couple-hour road trip. Well, the distance between Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, and Nazareth, where Joseph and Mary lived, was 120 miles, approximately. Now, they traveled by donkey and on foot, so they could only travel about 4 miles an hour. And if they did that and travel about 7 hours a day, it would have taken them 4.5 days to go from Nazareth to Bethlehem. And remember, Mary was very pregnant at the time, so the trip itself was somewhat amazing. So that, in a nutshell, it's hard for me to take all the time, effort, and words and make it a nutshell, but that's in essence it is.
Okay, so what we have is we have a C-shaped table. We have certain people sitting at certain places in the Last Supper, which is not exactly what the Last Supper by Da Vinci. Now, didn't Da Vinci have a patron that was paying for the Last Supper that he kind of had to satisfy?
Absolutely. Not only that, it was put in one of the basilicas, and so not only did he have a patron who was paying him, but there was the church hierarchy that he had to appease at least by how he depicted it. And of course, there are all sorts of conspiracy theories about what the meanings were and why he did it. And I'm sure politics played a very big part in it, even if it was politics of that day.
Right.
And I would imagine
that makes sense.
That,
yes, Trey?
I would imagine in that painting, you're going to see the face of the patron, or you're going to see the face of some higher church person, because obviously no one knows what Jesus looked like. No one knows what any of the disciples looked like. So I would imagine,
certainly,
taking the artistic license, you're going to put the faces of the people in the portraits that you want to have a presence.
And that would have been common for that time, yes.
Yes. Rome, and I can't remember where, because I saw a lot of churches and a lot of paintings, but it was very interesting. They had the Archangel Michael standing on the neck of Satan, and the person he was standing on, well, the predecessor pope was portrayed as Satan, and the current pope was portrayed as the Archangel Michael. And
of course.
So it really is interesting when you see all the things an artist would do with a painting, because there are political messages in it in just about every painting, and especially if it had something to do with the church.
Right.
Wow. That's a great observation, Trey, and thanks for that one. So Ralph, we've talked a little bit about the Last Supper, and we've talked about Jesus and what he might have done. When we talked this past Saturday night, you discussed the general type of life that Jesus might have led from age birth to 13. Do you mind sharing
right.
that with us?
No, happily. You know, we use the King James Version. I use King James Version of the Bible as the underpinning or the framework around which I wrote. And it was very clear that when the wise men visited the manger in Bethlehem, they had come from meeting with Herod, and Herod asked them that when they found the baby, tell him where he was because he wanted to come and worship. And I think they were wise enough, if they were wise men, they knew that there was going to, that he wanted to dispose of the child. And when they didn't come back, Herod ordered all children beneath the age of 3 to be killed. And so prior to that, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph went to Egypt. It's my belief they went to Alexandria because that was the largest assemblance of Jewish people outside of the Holy Land. So it would be logical they would go there, and Joseph was a carpenter. And so my belief, or the proposition I provide in the story, is that Jesus was a friend of Judas's, as Joseph worked for Judas's father. So they were, it all fit together in at least a cohesive way, if not. And what I do is I try to write things that are plausible. They may not be believable, but at least they're plausible. And so that to me was a plausible answer to why Egypt, where Egypt, and how did Jesus and Judas meet. I have also that they're both educated by Philo, who was one of the preeminent teachers in Alexandria at that time. And so that's how I think they met. And Jesus actually, the story goes that Judas hid in, they were working together with their fathers, and they went out and cut a tree. And in the process of cutting the tree, Judas, I think, cut his leg rather badly, and Jesus healed it. And so there was a bond of, Judas now owes Jesus for saving his life. And I think that, again, gets down to the answer of why would Judas betray Jesus, because I'm not sure betray is the right word. And I've tried to find the exact word that Jesus would have used at the Last Supper, where he said, now go do what you're here to do. I think that was more not go betray me, but go do what we've agreed to do. Because I think Jesus understood that without the, quote, betrayal, without the crucifixion, without the resurrection, his ministry would have been, for whatever it was, it would certainly not have been the basis for religion.
I find that very interesting in when you look at the Bible, when people interpret the Bible literally, an English version, it's already been translated from the Greek to Latin, and then finally meanders its way around to different languages. You really do lose words in translation. One of the things I remember is when the word Abba for father.
Yeah.
But it really doesn't mean father. It's more, as it was explained to me, it's more like daddy. That's just a completely different definition. If you say this
it's
is my
familiar,
father,
Yeah, it's a familiar word rather than. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's very subtle differences, but because it's translated through multiple interpretations and languages, it's really hard to figure out the exact literal meaning of just about any given word that you read in a translation.
And additionally, Trey, is that we don't know how many times scribes have translated the translated because they put their own opinion in some places. The manuscripts that ended up as the King James Version. So I actually, part of the research, I have one very close friend who is an ordained minister, and she's also has 4 PhDs, one of which is in biblical languages. So I include her in all of my religious writing research because, to me, she is able to read at least the closest to it should be, because it didn't translate it.
She can get the nuances of the phrases as well as the translation of the word that she's currently looking at.
Absolutely. And I guess that's part of the reason why I have a little bit of a problem with the whole concept of inerrancy, is that how can you believe, even the Bible itself, how can you believe that every word means exactly what it says in English when it was never written that way to begin with? And Jesus states in the Bible that he teaches with parables, which are allegories. They're not true stories, but they do make a point.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a red flag in front of a bull when I say that to the Baptist ministers that I grew up going to church with. So, but Kay wrote me, I sent a manuscript to her, and she said, I cannot imagine how many hours of research it took to, you put into this work, and on so many levels. I love history, I love the culture, and I really enjoy your side notes and explanations in the text that provide such interesting and backstory as your story unfolds. Excuse me, and that's what I try to do is, we talk about Mary, but who is she? And so there's a little paragraph. Her name at that time would have been Miriam Moore in Latin, that would be her name. And we know very little about her, and I still don't know a whole lot more, but I do take a paragraph and insert it in the story to explain some of these characters and then some of the backdrop of where they live and what they're doing. So it's not really just a story, but it's designed to be to whatever educational as people read it.
Right. I think it's a wonderful way to approach it, because when you look at the historical Jesus as documented in Josephus's texts and all, to me was always just a very fascinating part, because what you read literally is not literal at all.
Right.
It's more of an idea, something that hopefully translates close to the approximation, but to actually dissect it to figure out, you know, in the Catholic ceremony, mixing the water and the wine. Well, it was common to mix water with wine. So the Romans did that because they never were sure how much alcohol was in the wine, and they would water the wine down so it wouldn't knock them on their rears.
Right.
Things like that we look at, and when Jesus did wash the feet of the disciples, you say, well, what's the big deal? Well, when you look at, again, the statue of Saddam Hussein, as it was toppled, people threw their shoes at it, and they would – it's improper – to show the bottom of your feet to someone, because that's an insult. Well, unless you understand the cultural texts, the culturalisms that are expressed, it gives you an idea if Jesus were to wash the feet of his disciples. And I think it was Peter that said, you will never wash my feet, Lord. And he
right.
said, no, you don't understand. If you don't let me wash your feet, this doesn't work, as from the servant
yeah.
aspect. But,
you won't be able to be with me any farther along. The other thing is, I don't know how many of us are married, but, you know, that's a part of the culture. It's a lifestyle. And, if everybody walked around barefooted, and when you went into somebody's house, the first customary action was to wash your feet. Now, that could be interpreted as a sign of respect, but there were all sorts of other benefits by having your guests having clean feet. They didn't mess up your house. And that's never discussed, but there has to be a reason for it, too.
Right. And even today in the Muslim world, when you go into a place of worship, you take your shoes off. So I got to visit Egypt a while ago, and, you know, out in front of the place of worship, there'd be piles of shoes. That's just
absolutely
how it's done. And there's places where you can wash your hands and wash your feet so you externally cleanse before you go into a house of worship. It's all part of the culture.
My wife and I were in India a couple of years ago doing some work with a church there, and my wife wanted to go and take a walk through the church, and there was a man whose job was to stand in front of the church, and this is a Christian church, but it was still, his job was to stand in front of the church and make certain no one walked in with shoes on. And he counseled my wife that, when you come here on Sunday, you'll have to take your shoes off too. And she said to him, well, that's okay with me. My Sunday shoes hurt my feet anyway. So we just... You know, it and these customs are not new. They've been there many, many centuries. So, and
that's
buddy.
Incredible.
Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying that's incredible. The research that you've done about the culture, and that you can bring that in to our discussion tonight. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask each of our other panelists to ask a question, because I know everybody's excited about this, and we've learned a lot about the life of Jesus as interpreted by Ralph Jarrells because of what he knows about history. So, Keith, do you have a question for Ralph?
Yeah, absolutely. Ralph. So
yes,
I've done a little bit of research here, clearly not as much as you, but so I've read this story. I guess it's like BBC certified or something like that. That Jesus was actually a Buddhist monk named Isa, and I guess after the resurrection, he went and lived in like India or something like that for a period of time. And also, do you know, I'm sure you know about the Gospel of Thomas. Apparently Jesus went to India and studied under some masters or something for a period of time. That's how he obtained some of his knowledge. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, to answer your question, I'll separate my thoughts on it from what I did for the book. The book uses... the King James Version literally as the framework. So I don't go outside the theology, because that opens even more criticism than I've already gotten about what I should and shouldn't have done in the book. But it also has a tendency, what I did narrows down the subject matter and allows me to write it in a reasonable fashion in a fairly easily readable book of just a little over 300 pages. I believe that, first of all, one of the Indian masters has a retreat in Myrtle Beach, and that's
Mayor
Baba's. Mayor Baba's retreat there, and I have the pleasure of being a guest there anytime that they have space and I want to go. But I've also done a lot of research there just in general. And Baba has references to Jesus in probably, I would say, 24 pieces of his writing. So it seems to me that he would have had to have had some direct contact with the, the Indian intelligentsia at that time, and that it's possible that that is basis for some parts of his belief and much of his teaching. Now, I believe that, but like I say in the book, I don't drag that in because it would amplify what I'd had to talk about, and I do make the statement in the opening of the book that the King James Version is the framework that I'm working under. But, yeah, okay. I don't think I answered your question, but that's the basis of how the book was done.
You didn't answer the question directly, but you did answer the question because you stated that's what your book is about. You stated where you what your framework is on it, and that's pretty cool. That's really interesting. You came up with that much information from it. That's really cool, man. So thank you.
Well, I'm not sure you all have had time to, if you have the interest in reading the book, I'm not sure you've had time to get it or read it. And I'm always interested in comments of people who, I'm really interested in comments of people who actually buy the book, because if they didn't buy it, I'm not sure their opinion's worthwhile paying much attention to. But I would, and to everyone on the call, I would appreciate if you read the book that you let me know what you think of it, what you agree with, and what you disagree with.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's something
we can do.
Hello?
John, where
can we get a copy of your book?
Oh, where can we get it? Shame on me. I haven't said. Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, Books A Million, all of the online booksellers, the book's available in the UK. It's available in Australia. It's available throughout Europe at booksellers. If it's not actually on their shelves, any of these places can order them. And but the easiest, quickest way to get your hands on a copy would be Amazon. Of course, I make more if I sell you the book personally, but that's another story.
Right. And one thing that I wanted to add, when you talked about Mayor Baba, a lot of people are not familiar with Mayor Baba. And I am, because I've been to his spiritual center in Myrtle Beach many times. And what they propose, which I think is very interesting, is that during this epoch, which is a period of about 50,000 years, there were seven messengers of God. There was Zoroaster, who was the first person to deal with a monotheistic religion, not all kinds of gods, not like the Greek did with Apollo and Zeus and all this. But Zoroaster was in Iran, and he dealt with he was the first to deal with monotheistic religion. The other messengers of God that have been here, according to the Mayer Spiritual Center, are Rama, Krishna, Buddha, Mohammed, Jesus, the Son of God, and the Father of God during this epoch, which is Mayer Baba. And it's very interesting that there is a 500-acre beautiful facility there right next to the ocean, with the only freshwater lake right next to the ocean fed by underground streams, so that during the end times, if his people need to come and live, they can live there. They can fish, they can hunt, they can do everything. It's a beautiful place. I've been there many, many times, and it's an amazing place. Mayer Baba, at 21 years old, never spoke. He never spoke. He was a holy man, but he wrote, and he was actually friends with Simeon Chapin's daughter, Simeon Chapin of Burroughs and Chapin, that owned most of Myrtle Beach. And she got that 500 acres deeded over into the Mayer Spiritual Center. Now, people have tried as hard as they can to get that for commercial development, but they can't. And it's very interesting, the Mayer Spiritual Center. Please come down. I'll give you a tour. I think it's worthwhile. And it's a very interesting story that we're in a 50,000-year epoch, whatever that means. So it's interesting. Now, we got two more of our panelists. Mayer, first of all, the amazing Velvet. I'm sure you have a question for Ralph Jarrells.
My question would be this. You talked about the washing of the feet for a little bit. Do you think that has transposed in today's world, that people believe in it so much that that's why they take their shoes off at the front door before they come in the house? Do you kind of parlay that to today?
Well, I think so many of cultural activities have a basis in history. They may not believe that now, but they do what their parents did, what their grandparents did, and go on and on and
right.
on. But, you know, I use the example, a story that I have no idea is true, but it's certainly
right.
as good an illustration as not, is that this young woman was getting ready to prepare ham, and she had about 6 inches of the shank bone cut off. And her husband said, well, why do you do that? And she said, you know, I don't have the slightest idea. That's how my mother prepared it. So they called her mother, and the mother said, she asked the question of her mother. The mother said, you know, I don't have any idea why I did that. It's what my mother did. So they called her grandmother and asked the same question, and she said, well, I had to cut it off. My pot was too small. So
that's good.
So here are three generations doing the same thing, two of them not having any idea why they're doing it, only because,
right.
well, that's the way mother did. So I think the shoe thing, I think there are many customs within our religions that are based on meaningful issues many generations before. And the shoe
right.
thing, I think that the logical answer, at least to me, is that if people did not wash their feet before they came into the houses that they lived in, they would be dragging all sorts of stuff in, and the places would be dirty. And that's bad enough when you look at what a first century Israel house or Israeli house looks like. It's going to be fairly dirty anyway, so any effort to make it cleaner would be logical.
And right.
If that then took on spiritual meaning, because, yeah, you wash your feet at home, and so we're going to wash your feet at church because the same reason, and then the next generation does it, and the next, and before long, your church is clean, has,
right,
you know, clean floors and everything, but you're still doing the function of what was done many years before. That's my belief, but, you know, I'm certainly not educated in that way, or I have
right,
a tendency to
understand.
Use things that are logical.
Right.
And Ralph,
absolutely.
That's what you've taught us, is that if you use a little bit of logic and common sense and look at the behaviors of people during that era, you will get a lot of Ralph Jarrell's book. You know, the idea
yes,
that they
will.
Went to Alexandria, well, it was the largest Jewish community, so there's a very real chance that they went there, and there's a very real chance that Joseph the carpenter met Judas's father, who was a master carpenter, correct?
Correct. And
it makes sense.
Not only that, but it gives me fodder for a good book, I think. And it makes it easier to write if there is some logic behind what you're writing. Or at least that's how I feel anyway.
All right. Well, that's great. That's good commentary about it. Now, Devin, our man from West Hollywood, Devin, do you have a question for Ralph?
Sure. Yeah, I liked how you mentioned, you know, when you're writing historical fiction, that you kind of have, you know, the facts as best you can research and find them, but then you kind of get to fill in the rest. So I'm just curious, you know, how much liberties did you take and how creative did you get with filling in some of those details? And maybe if you have like an example of maybe where you got really creative, I'd love to hear that.
I try to... I guess really to answer your question, I'm going to take whatever liberties I think necessary to make it a good story. But my experience has been that you don't have to take many, because the facts that are available, and when you take into account geography, culture, climate, religious activities, because again, Jesus was a Jew. So Jesus would have done all things Jewish, whether we like it or not. And that's why I think the Last Supper would have been the Seder meal. So, and like I say, I grew up Southern Baptist, so I've got a jaded viewpoint to begin with. But my friends have a tendency to not like the writing when I write religious stuff. So, because there are facts that we as churches don't want to admit that was part of Jesus' life. And there's so much. When he lived in Nazareth, to think that there were five major Jewish holidays that any practicing Jew was probably required to attend or would attend, and that would have been done in in Jerusalem, and again, from Nazareth to Jerusalem was 120 miles. So this wasn't just run down. It was a 4.5-day trip in each direction, at least. So, and travel and all the things that we look at when we make a trip didn't exist. I mean, you couldn't go down to the restaurant on the corner and get a hamburger because neither of them existed. So how did they travel? What was it? There's just so much that we don't comprehend of life during that time. So I've tried to build as much of that in without encumbering the story as I can. I think it needs to be, I think when someone reads it, they need to be educated, they need to be entertained, they need to be, the story needs to move them from beginning to end without, you know, beating them about the head with a rubber hose about something. I want the book to be interesting. I want it to be a good novel and a good historic fiction novel. And that's basically how I go about this. So I don't include everything.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I think your attention to detail, that's really what can put the reader in the right, you know, mindset and mood to really enjoy the story.
I hope so.
All right. Well, I normally don't make comments. This is Dr. John, but I'll make a comment.
Sure.
Many of us are familiar with Occam's razor, and that is the philosophy that the simplest explanation is likely the correct explanation. Now, sometimes it's not, but I believe what you're doing is you're taking the simplest and most straightforward explanation and putting that together in a historical novel, which I think is phenomenal. And that's something that I believe that that many, many historical fiction writers should do because, you know, and I never thought about it until I interviewed you first time this past Saturday night. And that's what you're doing. And I think it's the correct way to do it. It's kind of the genius maneuver that you get what you get out of the Occam's razor scenario of let's look at the most straightforward solution to what Jesus did, where he could have gone. I mean, he could have gone to Ethiopia. He could have gone to a million different places. But let's say that he went to the Jewish community with none other than Andrea. And then he met his father met this man father of Judas, and Judas and Jesus, because their fathers were together,
breaking up,
became very close friends because he was picked as one of the disciples.
Yes. Well,
so it's just I think it's a wonderful thing.
And if you look at a map, Egypt. Proximity to Judea would have been a logical place to go, but it was there because the Roman government did not have control of it. So that was his only really safe place would be to get out from under Roman control. So that's why I say part of how I look at this is everything happens literally for a reason, one way or another. And we don't know all the reasons, and we never will, probably. But if it's logical, just as you say, if it's the simplest answer, then there's a good chance that's what happened.
Exactly.
Hey, John.
All right, now, Steve, do you have a question for Ralph? Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. I'm kind of interested in entertainment and how that plays with theology. I see a lot of Judas in pro wrestling even today. I wanted to get your thoughts on, was there any writers that made you want to kind of influence you into writing a religious novel? And are there any thoughts on Dan Brown, Da Vinci Code writer?
Well, let me answer the first part of the question because I have a lot of comments about Dan Brown. But the first part of the question, was there any writer that influenced me to write the book or write religious books? And actually,
yeah.
No. I actually ended up as a teenager. My mother parked me in the church every time the door was open. And so I ended up with the Southern Baptist most conservative view of everything that was in the Bible. But even with that, there were questions. My first novel was my first question, which was, what happened to the 30 pieces of silver Judas was given? Because that, to me, was a major talisman of the Christian religion, and we have a very short history of those pieces of silver. And yet, what would happen if they actually stayed together and were transported in time and space to somewhere else? And so the first novel is called Ill Gotten Gain, and that's the story of the 30 pieces of silver that get to Charleston, South Carolina. And Charleston is a setting for two of my novels because I was familiar with it. My mother was from Charleston. I have a lot more relatives there than sometimes I want to recognize. But, you know, I knew Charleston, a lot about it, knew a lot of the history, but I also knew a lot of the way it is today. And so that's why Ill-Gotten Gain was set there, and that's why Ambani was set there. I came up with a story idea for the 30 pieces of silver and how they move through time and space to Charleston current time. That's a whole other topic and has nothing to do with Jesus Judas. But the same thing was true when I found out that Judas was from Judea and the rest of the disciples were from Galilee. So that was the basis for there had to be some set of circumstances that would bring these two people together. And that was the basis of the story. Now, when I got started researching it, there were a lot of very interesting loops that would bring you back together that would make it believe that certain parts of this could be, if not was, true. And so that's where the idea of the book came from. I have all of Dan Brown's books. I have videotapes of the two movies. Prior to seeing or hearing about the Da Vinci Code, I had read thoroughly, probably three or four times, a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And if you're not familiar with it, it really is worth the time and effort to read. It was three investigative reporters from the BBC got to looking into a variety of topics, one, secret societies in Europe at that time, about the belief that Mary was actually pregnant with Jesus's baby when Jesus was killed, and she was moved to France. They have elements of documentation that either you believe or you don't. That's the personal interpretations. But the stories in it have a great deal of the same basis of Dan Brown's book. And I think even though he doesn't openly credit it, I think he should have. But again, do we know about the whole thing about this, about Holy Blood, Holy Grail, is an organization called the I didn't know we were going to talk about this, so I didn't do my research, but it's a secret society with grandmasters who were the literati of that time. And Leonardo da Vinci is one of the supposed grandmasters of the Sons of Sion, S-I-O-N. Sion and Z-I-O-N are sort of too close for me not to believe that they're, maybe it was just a misprint. But again, if you are interested in that, particularly that the book and movie, then I think you would have a whole new give you a whole new viewpoint with reading the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Excuse me.
Okay.
So, again, yeah, I'm not sure I answered your question.
No, it was interesting. I was wondering how far I wasn't sure if it was a novel or if it was like an essay type book, but nonfiction. But I'm glad I cleared that up earlier. And I was wondering how forward it went. And you mentioned Charleston, so. Do you see Judas and any 20th century personalities?
I don't make an effort to do that. I really don't.
Okay.
I could if I wanted to, I guess, because there are a lot of people who I think have this personality, whether or not it's actually a cross time or reality, or if it's just something you want to see. But there are a lot of people you could say look like Judas anyway. But I don't propose to be willing to make that as a point.
Oh, I'm glad
have
to
you
asked.
Steve, have you heard of Holy Blood, Holy Grail?
No, I was looking it up as you were talking about it, so I'm going to definitely check out. I'm going to see if I can find your novel and that book as well and see if I can get it. At least read the summary of it and possibly read it.
Okay. It's
I think that'll be very interesting, Steve, and that's something that I'm going to do as well. And I want to close this section with Dr. Trey Donaway. Do you have a question for Ralph? And then we're going to move to a more speculative topic that relates to this. And Ralph, this is one that we got to this past Saturday night. So Trey, do you have a question for Ralph?
I don't, but I've got an observation. And Ralph, you're a brave author. I know people hold their religions close to their heart, sometimes more than their brain. And when someone comes with a different perspective, people tend to get pretty defensive about this. I know.
Yes.
I visited France. I went to the Ile de Cité, and I saw Sainte-Chapelle, which is truly, I think, the most beautiful building with stained glass I've ever been in. And, of course, it housed Jesus's crown of thorns, which was moved to moved to Notre Dame. And when Notre Dame caught fire recently, a priest ran in and grabbed the same crown of thorns that Sainte-Chapelle was created to hold. And I remember reading all the different articles, a piece of the true cross, all these things that were sold probably by some very happy rug merchant from the Middle East. But, you know, the belief in objects to link something directly to Christ is a human desire throughout the ages. So when you go and rock their boat by just stating the historical facts and stating the obvious, which people tend not to look at, but also, you know, and again, this is where I'm blending our conversations. We talk a lot about conspiracy theories on this podcast. We're often talking about conspiracy theories because if there's a gap in knowledge, then it lends itself to a conspiracy theory. Well, there's very little known about Jesus's life until his ministry. So the fact that you've filled in with conjecture, but still filled in something that is plausible and that would make sense, it would make a fascinating read. You're not writing gospel, but you are writing things that very well could have happened. As we say in professional speaking, it's not that you're not saying the truth. You're not saying exactly what happened, but you're saying something that could have happened. And that's what you've done, and which is why I've already ordered your book now. So I look forward to reading it.
Good. And I've said many times that, anybody can critique it, but I'll pay attention to the ones who I know have bought the book, and the other people can say whatever they want, and it doesn't bother me. Part of what you've just said is exactly, I don't consider myself brave, but thank you for that as an observation. But a lot of my conservative Christian friends have sort of distanced themselves to an extent from me after the book. And, it's not that I believe one thing or another thing. My wife and I have a very active Christian ministry in the country of Belize, and we continue. And it doesn't change what we do there, and what we do there doesn't change my writing a story. Just as an aside, 3 years ago we were visiting with a minister in the Toledo district of Belize, which is the poorest district of Belize. And we were asking him if there was anything we could do to help them. And he read off the litany of things that anybody on a foreign mission field would do, which is, well, we need to build some churches, so we need construction. We need youth programs because we want to bring the youth in because they'll bring their parents in. And he just was going on and on about the needs. And then almost as an aside, he said, and I have 90 boys that want to play Little League, and we have two bats, two balls, and two gloves. My wife, who shocked me, I had to almost get off the floor, said, I'll take that. And, there's a belief that God's involved. Okay, I can believe that. And if someone else does or doesn't, that's up to them. But in the past 3 years, we've gotten equipment donated to outfit 36 baseball teams. And
that's
so funny. We have a little, we've had almost, we have almost 40, almost 500 kids in a program where they have Bible study and then they practice. So, and they are, well, they're not playing now because of COVID, but the teams are organized and they're outfitted thanks to donations from people predominantly in Lexington County, South Carolina, and other organizations and the Rotary Club that I belong to. Now, at the same time, we found an organization called Harvest Aviation that flies mission stuff to the country of Belize at no charge. So we've gathered the equipment pretty much for no financial investment, and we've gathered and we've gotten it to them. And like I say, they're now theoretically playing as soon as they can get back on the field. So, and I guess that intellectually I separate both of those. I can write a book like Jesus, Judas, Best Friend Forever, and I expect it to be hopefully a good read, so a good book, and to be culturally, geographically, climatically, and religiously plausible, because
I think it's a wonderful concept, and again I applaud you for that, and I think people need to realize that you have written a fictional novel, and fictional novels have to be able to carry a reader. If you're just going to give dry fact, you might as well just read the history book. If you want just dry fact, you might just want to read a textbook on the New Testament. But if you want to enjoy a story and have it make points, just as Jesus did, I think your vehicle is a wonderful one you've made. And a very wise priest friend of mine said, he said, no matter what you say, no matter what religion you are, no matter what branch of Christianity or non-Christian denominations, he said he thought when you boil it all down, the simplest, most direct way is to say Jesus' whole point for human beings was very simple, and he summed it up in two words: play nice.
Yeah.
Play nice.
That's it.
Love thy neighbor, play nice.
Yeah.
So
if everybody did that, for going up against
people who are so rigid in their religious personal beliefs that you offer a different version of Christianity so people can truly enjoy a story, will reach people that perhaps have not been reached.
Yeah. Well, thank you for understanding, and I, as I said, I appreciate it. When you read it, if you like it, or even if you don't, that you let me know your feelings.
I'll let you know, Ralph. I sure will.
Good.
Wow, that's great. Now, Ralph, I've got a quick question for you. What's your Rotary Club? Mine is the Shalot Rotary Club in Shalot, North Carolina. Which one is your Rotary Club?
Which is that, please? I'm sorry.
What is your Rotary Club city? What city is your Rotary Club in?
Oh, in West Columbia.
Able to hear that? Oh, okay, great. Well, that's wonderful. Well, we'll have to invite you to come talk at ours, because I think my Rotary Club would really enjoy what you've got to say about your ministry in Belize, and they'd probably be glad to help. I will maybe say that out of turn, but I think they would. So we'll discuss that later.
Are they in Myrtle Beach?
It's in Shalot, which is Brunswick County, just north of Myrtle Beach. And so we'll discuss that later. But I want to say that, you know, we really appreciated having you on here tonight. We've got another topic, and I think we'll save that for the next time, because I'd love to have you back in a month or two after you've got some things going on, and we'd love to have you back and talk about our second topic that we got into this past Saturday night, which was Giants. And it was kind of an interesting discussion, and maybe we'll do a little preparation for it. But we wanted to say thank
Absolutely.
You very much for coming on tonight with ScaryCast. I want to thank our hosts, Dr. Trey Donaway, Keith Bassetti, Devin Tate, Steve Logan, and I guess me, and we've had a lot of fun. I hope I didn't.
And the amazing Velvet.
Oh, and of course, the amazing Velvet. I'm sorry. It's just getting late, and sometimes I forget. But and you better remind me, because
you need to go see
Dr.
Trey then, because you need help.
I probably do.
I don't do that kind of medicine.
But anyway.
Yeah, listen, nobody does that kind of medicine, sir, okay? Just to let you know.
No, not for me.
Yeah, remember, I'm a surgeon,
right.
You know. If in doubt, cut it out.
Well, you know what? We might have to do
Wait a minute, is that coming from
later.
The surgeon?
Those are the two main tenets of surgery, you know.
Okay. Cut something. John, we're cutting something out.
Yeah,
it must
doubt,
be my brain.
Doubt, cut it out.
I understand.
Cut now, think later. Yeah.
Sounds like a lobotomy.
Yeah, that's a lobotomy right there.
I'm going to have to ask
my publisher
if he's a surgeon.
Yeah.
All right, so
well,
thank you, everyone.
Being a publisher,
for
I'm
being
sure he would get the
cat.
Point as much as a surgeon.
Well, thank you, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate, first of all, John, for providing this as a platform, and I appreciate all of y'all investing your time in listening and asking questions, and that's part of the reason why an author takes the time and effort to put words on paper is to hopefully let somebody enjoy it, so... I thank you very much for your time.
Awesome. We thank you.
You're welcome. And we have some great authors that come on here once a month. We have John LeMay from Roswell, New Mexico. He comes on and talks about his books on UFOs, the paranormal. We love having John here. I spoke with him this week. In fact, I spoke with him this evening, and he said that he's going to be here in 2 weeks, and we're going to be talking about Roswell UFOs and the latest scuttle that's going on, because there's a lot going on. So, of course, we want to have all of our co-hosts and the Queen of ScaryCast, Robin. She'll be back by then, and we'll be glad to have her there. So, Ralph, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have such a gentleman and a scholar, and it's been great to having all of the co-hosts. And we'll see you next week, 9 p.m. Eastern, on the one, the only. It's ScaryCast. We'll see you then. Live from Myrtle Beach. Take care, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.